Marconi, but a patent was revoked. So the full rights were given to Tesla, dead now, but money weren't. Enter again.
Yeah, you sounded like you were a little bit skeptical about this system, Roy. It's real. And I think there's some articles on the internet that we'll find of people who set up relatively simple receiving systems that have listened to this, where John has a receiver that goes down to those low frequencies. He's in line to be able to be part of this couple of times per year transmission by the Swedish station. So what made you skeptical about this, Roy? AC2GS, K2LAW?
Not at all skeptical of the station. I believe the station exists. I believe the station has existed since about 1924. I just don't think it's putting out a megawatt. All the stuff that I've been able to quickly read about it suggests that these days it's only used at about 80 kilowatts. But I believe it exists. I just didn't agree with what I thought Wesley was saying. The Nobel Prize, to my knowledge, has never been retracted from any winner. There have been some cases where they were considering people. You can't get it posthumously unless the committee doesn't know that you died. And so sometimes people were up for it, and when the committee found out that they died, they weren't presented with it. But no one's been retracted from the Nobel Prize. That's what I was a little bit curious about.
VDH with some comments.
Go ahead, John.
Yeah, fine business. Yeah, I think you're right, Roy. I think now they only operate it at a reduced power of 80 kilowatts or something like that. And it's only operated as a kind of a tourist attraction, just as like a memorial. It's not put to any kind of military or serious use. They just fire it up two or three times a year as an attraction for people who are interested in it. And you're right, I think there is a YouTube complete video that runs about 20, 25 minutes. It shows one of their processes where they do fire the station up and actually do go on the air. I think somebody put it up on YouTube. And yeah, as far as my receiver, yeah, actually the NRD 515, it does tune down to DC. I can actually tune it down to the local oscillator frequency. It actually tunes down to zero. Below about 30 kilohertz or so, the sensitivity drops off. So it's not that sensitive at the very low area, but there is some interesting things down there. Just let me drop. Some of the interesting things down there, at 518 kilohertz, there's a service called NavTex, where in SITOR mode B, they give you a lot of marine aviation, marine text information about various marine conditions around the East Coast here. Also, there's a service called Differential GPS that some GPS receivers can use, which provides a correction and increased accuracy to the GPS reception. That's transmitted as a teletype correction signal that goes out around 200, 250 kilohertz in that area. Go ahead.
Good information, John. Thank you. And Roy, 80 kilowatts is still a significant amount of power by amateur standards. And yes, I guess the station, under ideal conditions, is capable of going to a couple of hundred kilowatts. The Project Sanguine, the American system that talks through our submarines, runs, one or two megawatts, an awful lot of power. Just to make sure the signal gets through down to 60 feet below salt water. The fact that you can send a radio signal below salt water to a long wire being trailed behind a submarine is kind of amazing to me, that the signal manages to get there worldwide. It's a very low speed, Morse code-like signal, heavily encoded. In other words, if you send three letters, those three letters, when translated, might mean bomb Moscow now. Now that's a joke, but in theory, it's possible. The mode of propagation at those low frequencies is kind of amazing, and how that signal gets through when there's a thunderstorm that might be going on in the area is a little bit amazing to me. And the receiver itself is probably only a couple of hertz wide at that frequency. That's all it's got to be in order to get a good signal-to-noise ratio. So, I'm pretty sure if we dig deep enough, we'll find articles on YouTube and other places of how people have set up relatively simple receivers to listen to these transmissions by the Swedish station, which happened a couple of times per year. And so a number of people have, stateside as well as other countries, listen to that signal. And if you have any further questions or comments on this particular subject, give me a call, let us right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
W2AS.
W2. Alpha Sierra Charlie is what it sounds like. Start up with your name, sir, and then your question or comment.
The name is Tony, and just a comment. A little Googling led to a website run by retirees of that station. Very informative, full virtual tour, and some information about the apparatus as well. Website alexander.n.sv.
Okay, that's good information there, Tony. From what you've seen, it strikes me as not a very expensive receiver system in order to listen to that. Is that roughly true, Tony?
Roger. They're actually saying an active antenna hooked to a computer is adequate.
So you're saying the receiver, that the computer itself is doing the frequency selection and demodulation? Is that what you're saying, Tony? Go ahead.
I'm just skimming through this here, but it seems like they're just saying you can practically use a computer sound card.
It does make sense. The sound card does go to that frequency. How about that? With the right kind of a preselector. The curve trace that you've got on the audio system, so I guess you could emphasize the 17 kilohertz and reject everything else by the way you set all the controls. Oh, interesting. Anybody have any further questions or comments? Give me a call, that is right now, K2RIW.
And just one last comment. They're actually going to be transmitting on Christmas Eve, 2 days from now.
Do we know what time of day the transmission takes place, Tony?
We have one day, 5 hours, 51 minutes, and 30 seconds. They have a countdown timer on the website. So it doesn't say the actual time, but you can figure it out, I will mention.
Good information. Thank you, Tony. Okay, the next person who signed in, which we've been keeping him waiting an awful long time, is Lee. Kilo Delta 2, Foxtrot, Juliet, Bravo. Are you still there, Lee? K2RIW in the tech man?
WA2RYY with a comment.
Hey, Jeff, you're still around. No comment, really, other than, you know, the SAG station not having a 270 kilowatt theoretical maximum. It's really just 200 kilowatts because you don't have enough windings to take advantage of the motor output. But that being said, just sticking around, listening, and having an enjoyable evening. So back to net from KB to After B.
Dick, do you hear the Joe trying to get in?
Yes, I did. Okay, so Lee, I thought you had a question that you were about to ask us. To be to RYY, go ahead, Joe.
W2RYY. Yeah, well, I'm transferring on the east. I know the other thing at west will blank it out when you try to come in because it's being quick on the button. You were talking about these systems that send information on the command frequency to the submarines, which operates around 17 kilohertz. I know this went up a couple of million, I think around 17.8 kilohertz, running about 1.8 megawatts. That technology is fascinating. You know what's even more fascinating than that? Is that what I started reading in Google Google on this, and is they use like a frequency shift method of operation, which shifts the frequency about 50 hertz or something like that. Not only is that fascinating, but they actually have resonance circuits, or a way of resonating the circuit as the frequency shifts. It instantaneously keeps the thing in resonance all the time, because apparently at 17 kilohertz, that's quite a change in bandwidth or for your original assigned frequency. So how's that for technology?
CW, continuous signal. And so that's how the data is transmitted. That's amplitude modulated. It's frequency shifted modulated. And there's a name for that kind of communication and that kind of a modulation. I've forgotten it now. What's the name of that transmission mode of frequency shift keying? Maybe that's it. Binary frequency shift keying. Over to you, Joe, K2YW.
Isn't it F1?
Sounds right. Go ahead, Joe.
They mentioned a particular name for that, but as I said, I also started reading about the way they keep the antenna in resonance as the frequency shifts. So that's what I think is the interesting technology, how they can, you know, as fast as this shifting happens at a 50 hertz rate, that they keep the antenna continuously in resonance at all times.
Which is an extreme case of what I've been saying for years. When you're designing an antenna and you want it to radiate or receive, you resonate first, then it will radiate. And so once you can make an antenna capable of radiating, because of the law of reciprocity, in other words, however an antenna, a passive antenna that doesn't have an amplifier built into it, however an antenna works when transmitting, gain, efficiency, bandwidth, Q, rise time, fall time, all of these characteristics on transmission will be identical on reception. So making antenna capable of transmitting a milliwatts of power, so to speak, is enabling its reception. So to make an antenna at that lower frequency to receive that signal is not too difficult. It's kind of hard to believe that that lower frequency can propagate, obvious by the fact that a wristwatch can pick up that roughly 100 kc signal from WWB, I think it is, in order to reset the timing of your watch. Is a pretty strong example of how when you radiate enough power at that band, very simple receiving systems can pick it up a long distance away. And if there are further questions or comments on this subject, give me a call at us right now, K2IW and the TechNet.
With modulation mode for FM, the F1 is unmodulated carrier frequency shift. F2, that would be the frequency that is modulated by the carrier and by the signal, and the signal of usually 100 hertz is changing the frequency. Correct me if I'm wrong.
VDH with a comment.
Yeah, to resonate the antenna on each of the two frequencies as you're transmitting is a pretty crafty thing to do. Go ahead, John.
They transmit a very narrow shift reading. It's radio teletype. It's very heavily encrypted. I think they use the 156-bit encryption, very heavily encrypted, of course. But it is very narrow shift reading. I think it's like maybe 50 hertz shift. And yeah, they would have to retune the antenna for each frequency shift, because 50 hertz out of approximately 20 kilohertz is a big percentage change. When we do RIDI up at 7 megahertz or 14 megahertz, of course, that shift is a very, very small percentage. But those frequencies, it's a large percentage of frequency change, so they would have to re-resonate that.
And the most important thing about an antenna is whether or not it resonates. All of those antennas that are squeezed into a very small space inside of your cell phone are resonated. There's an integrated circuit chip right alongside of the antenna. It acts as an antenna tuner on each of the frequencies your cell phone wants to listen to. So the little antenna inside has to resonate, and you don't have to have a whip sticking outside anymore like we used to in the early days. Okay, I think the first section of the TechNet, we've answered all the questions of people who signed in. I'm pretty sure you didn't really have a question. Let me double check with Lee. Tilo Delta 2, Foxtrot, Juliet, Bravo. You didn't have a question that you wanted to ask Lee. Over to you, Lee, K2RIW.
That's affirmative. Negative question.
Very fine, Lee. Okay. Glad we didn't leave you out. Now we're going to go over to the second section where Roy has got a darn interesting puzzle he's going to be asking you tonight. AC2GS with the science talk and the mailbag, if there is any. K2RIW. You got it, Dr. Roy.
Well, thank you very much, Dick. I just want to check with you what the noise level of my signal is. It's very, very weird, the repeater lately. When Wesley was talking, the signal dropped by about 5 or 6 dBm as opposed to your talking and the other person. So, curious. I just want to know if I sound decent.
You sound very good, Roy. You're 95% signal, 5% noise. Just a little bit of hiss in the background. You're sounding good. Please proceed.
Okay, very well. As always, I wish I did have some mailbag questions. I keep asking people and waiting, and eventually someday someone's going to send me some mailbag questions for Dick to answer. In the old days when John was doing this, he sometimes reported that he had, 40, 50, 60 emails. I rarely get an email from the mailbag, but if you do have any technical questions that you would like to ask Dick and you're not able to get on the TechNet yourself, or if you have any information you would like to pass to Paul or topics you would like him to cover or websites that you've seen stories that you would like his opinion, or if you would like to contact me, if you would like to suggest a topic or a puzzler or a question or refute anything that I say, and please, when you do, give me some references. I really like those. The email address is very simple. It's mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. All the things that I will talk about for the most part will have links. I have a link right now up to a photograph that Paul sent me that he'll allude to during his space report. And my link page is roy.ac2gs.com. Again, the link page is roy.ac2gs.com. We also maintain a chat room. Everyone's invited. You can get there by just typing into your browser chat.ac2gs.com. And I offer an audio stream for people who can't get it any other way. That's at technet.ac2gs.com. With that all said and done, I will break for a second, and then I will go on with the puzzler and other things. Okay, before I actually get to the puzzler, I'd like to recommend at least two web articles that they tend to be much more visual than they are verbal, so I won't really go into them in too much detail. The first one is a collection of winning videos from Nikon's annual microscopic film contest. They call it their Small World in Motion video competition. So the link will be up there after the technical net. You can go there and click on it and look at it. They're very, very beautiful microscopic videos. The second one is an article showing some of the best visual illusions for 2019. I happen to like audio and visual illusions. Visual illusions don't really translate much on the radio, but if you go to that website and take a look, I'm sure it'll amuse you. Let me drop for a second, and then we'll get on to the puzzler. Okay, for tonight I have a rather small puzzler for listeners to ponder. There are 206 bones in the human body, at least in most coming off the factory showroom at the beginning of life, and to offer them a degree of voluntary motion, each one is equipped with 650 skeletal muscles, not counting all the muscle tissues that's lining the arteries, the arterioles, the veins, the bladders, the GI tract, our heart, and sundry other clumps of non-skeletal muscles hiding in each of our bodies. Now, the fingers of each hand are made up of 14 separate bones each. That's 28 total. So, my very small question for tonight is how many of those 650 skeletal muscles can be found in those dexterous fingers of yours? And since I'm a generous sort of a guy, I will give you a plus or minus 10 margin on that. So, anyone want to guess how many muscles are in your fingers? BDH would have guessed. I couldn't make out the first guy's call sign, so the first guy who kind of chirped in, if you want to do a guess, and then Rich will follow.
Chapter B, Kilo Delta 2, Foxtrot Julia Bravo, the name here is Lee. If the question is specifically how many muscles are in the fingers, I repeat, the fingers, my wager is zero. Back to net, KV Chapter B.
Okay, Rich, you wanted to give an opinion.
This is BDH, would I guess?
Okay, John.
I'm going to guess about 26 per hand. 26 per hand that is going down to the point of the wrist, of the order of 26, maybe as high as 30. Go ahead.
Okay, but that wasn't the question. The question is how many muscles are located in your fingers, not the palm of your hand.
Okay, for fingers of one hand, I would say of the order of 20. Good.
Okay, anyone else want to hazard a guess? Okay, well, for those playing along, if the question is how many muscles are in the palm, which isn't the question, there's about 17 in each of our palms. One more chance if anyone else has any ideas of how many muscles are stuck there in our digits. Please, give me your estimation. Very well. Well, Lee, KD2FJB is too clever for me. There are no muscles in your fingers. It's a rather ingenious pulley system. Sometimes people think that all the muscles are, in fact, in the forearm. But that's not totally the case. The extensors and flexors, the ones that open and close your hand for the most part, are located in your forearm, and by a pulley system, they are actuated in your hand. But the muscles that let you take your fingers and spread them wide apart and then squeeze them close together, those are the ones located in the palm of your hand. So no muscles in the fingers. Fingers are, for the most part, just bone and connective tissue and ligaments and tendons. I just thought that might be an interesting thing to try. I asked a few people outside of this technical net, and about 50% knew the answer and 50% didn't, so I thought I'd go for it. So that's our puzzler for tonight. I also set up a very, very small, obscure secondary puzzler if people came up with the answer too quickly, so I'll let it fly. What land bird lays the biggest egg for its body? So please, any guesses on what kind of a land bird lays the biggest egg for its body size? So it's in proportion to its body size, it's not just the total weight of the egg. Okay, no one wants to hazard a guess. I would have thought that someone would have said ostrich egg, personally.
Hey, Josh, you're me.
I'm pretty sure the Oxford tag is the biggest tag, but the question you have hazarded is the proportion of the bird to the egg. And now that I think about it, I can't think of a good answer for that one. KVJ, actually.
Haley, I would agree with you that it wouldn't be quite the correct answer, but it would sort of be, it's a very common bird. People kind of know the bird. They know the size of the egg. And even though I keep mentioning proportion, I thought someone would go for it. Now, the actual answer, and I guess it's not the most famous bird in the world, is the North Island brown kiwi. A female kiwi can lay an egg that's approximately 15 to 22% of her weight. So that's a damn big egg for a bird that size. So that's something to put in your trivia box for a rainy day. The North Island brown kiwi lays the largest egg for its particular body size.
One TDH with a question.
Yes, John.
In getting back to the muscle question, all of the muscles that move the fingers are located in your forearm, and the rest of it is just connecting tendons that connect to the various segments of the fingers?
No, the extensors and the flexors, the ones that grip and the ones that relax the grip, those are located in your forearm. There's a whole set of muscles that let you spread your fingers wide apart or bring them very close together. Those are located in the palm of your hand because it would be very difficult to mechanically do that type of operation as far away as your forearm. So it's a complicated interplay of palm muscles and forearm muscles, but there's no muscles in the actual fingers that, the three segments of the four regular fingers and the two segments of the thumb.
You know, now that I remember it, I remember in the Star Wars movie when Luke lost his hand and they replaced it with an artificial hand or something. I remember it showed a part where he was moving his fingers and they showed these little artificial tendons or whatever actually doing the moving of his fingers, now that I think about it. Okay, very interesting. Thanks. Thanks, Russ.
I also think there was sort of a similar scene in Terminator. There was a point where the Terminator injured his arm and had to do kind of surgery in a seedy motel and was moving pistons and rods and such and getting some motion out of them. So it was an eerily similar type of a scene. Anyway, so much for movies. We will move on to my usual little stories, and hopefully there'll be some questions and we'll be able to discuss some things. The first one is that many native Hawaiians have been protesting the construction of the proposed 30-meter telescope atop sacred Mauna Kea for months. They scored a victory this past Thursday when the Hawaiian governor, David Ige, announced that the construction efforts were hitting pause. The governor also announced that the state would be pulling state troopers from the site until further notice, so protesters said that they were told to clear out or face arrest. But even with no clear timeline for when the construction would begin on the mountain's sacred slopes, protesters have said that they have every intention of continuing to protect the dormant volcano. One thing is clear, they said, no matter what the state's plan, we will be here to protect the Moana. The group camping at the access road in Mauna Kea wrote on Twitter. While Ige and the 30-meter telescope have both said that the plans for construction are stalled indefinitely, the state's plan for dealing with the encampment at the base of Mauna Kea blocking the access to roads has been a source of confusion. Protesters said that after Ige's announcement, officers told them they had until December 26th to clear the road or they'd be arrested. quote, after spending $15 million on law enforcement operations since July, the state has decided they will continue to incur more by threatening a sweep if the protectors remain there till the 26th, the group went on via Twitter. Given the months-long protests to get to this point, it's unlikely native Hawaiians will back down. The key for Moana Kea is the latest front in a fight over native Hawaiian land rights and the way state-sanctioned institutions have dispossessed people without informed consent. Let me drop for a sec. Partners on the project have been trying for years to secure its development, but opponents won't let up. As a result, those partners, which include California Institute of Technology and the National Astronomical Observatory of Japan, have secured permits for a site on one of the Spanish Canary Islands and are considering whether to move construction there. The group says Moana Kea would be a superior site to view the cosmos, and the team is still dedicated to building the telescope there, but as protests have been drawn out, they've had to prepare for alternatives if construction becomes impossible. The telescope has opened up divisions in the scientific community. Hundreds of astronomers have sided with protesters, noting that science is not more important than human rights. Sure, this telescope would create the ability to gaze ever deep into the universe, but at what cost to people on Earth and the places that they hold sacred? For many of those opponents, Moana Kea isn't just a mountain, she's a relative, she's a family member. She's the burial ground of their ancestors, and the way they see it, she deserves to be seen as more than a construction site. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okay. This past Friday, the Department of Energy announced it would not allow amended standards for incandescent lamps to go into effect. Following the passage of the Energy Independence and Security Act of 2007, there was talk of a ban on incandescent lights, but that wasn't exactly what the rules mandated. While there have been regulatory pushes towards a more efficient LED lighting that's cheaper to use over time and better to reduce climate change-causing emissions, stricter definitions finalized by the Obama administration would have blocked the sale of bulbs under a certain level of efficiency beginning on January 1st, 2020. In combination with another change announced in September, the Energy Department is now blocking stricter rules and keeping older-style, less efficient lighting on the shelf. The current administration has argued that it favors consumers' choice of bulbs that may be available for cheaper upfront, says the LED bulbs dominating the marketplace shows new rules aren't needed. Conservationists and many others claim that this is not true at all, and incandescent bulbs have already been phased out by law in many other places, according to them. The move is backed by bulb manufacturers who want to dump their inefficient products that they haven't made in the U.S. for years on U.S. consumers. In response, the Natural Resources Defense Council noted several states, including California, Colorado, Nevada, Washington, and Vermont, have established their own higher standards for light bulbs. Also, 16 attorney generals are suing the administration over the move, and in November, New York Attorney General Letitia James said the United States cannot and will not be the exception to the international movement to phase out the inefficient, unnecessary, and costly use of incandescent bulbs. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okay, we have discussed trees in the past and our best idea of how water gets all the way up to their top. The tallest trees in the world are redwoods. A tree called Hyperion is the record winner in California. Discovered in 2006, it measures 379.7 feet. Now, although the Amazon rainforest trees don't grow nearly as high, researchers have discovered the tallest trees in the rainforest that they've found yet. At 289 feet, it dwarfs the previous Amazon record holders by almost 98 feet, and it's not alone either. The Guiana Shield of northeastern Amazonia, which accounts for nearly 9% of the world's remaining tropical forests, may contain lots of these gigantic trees, with each one able to hold as much carbon as an average hectare of rainforest. This discovery means that the vast jungle may be a greater carbon sink than previously believed. They didn't just stumble upon these trees while strolling in the forest belt. Between 2016 and 2018, Brazil's National Institute for Space Research coordinated a project to laser scan large swaths of the Amazon. This project scanned 850 randomly distributed patches of forest, each about 7.5 miles long and 98 feet wide. Seven of these patches contained evidence of trees taller than 262 feet. Most of them were located in the area surrounding the Jari River, a northern tributary of the Amazon. They set off by boat from Laranjal do Jari in northeastern Brazil in humid 35 degree centigrade heat, and the first stage of their journey took them to the village of São Francisco do Arapucuru, a community which produces sustainable Brazil nuts. The community provided 4 boats and 12 people to guide them up the river and through the dense, unforgiving forest. Once there, they measured the tallest tree heights the old-fashioned way by dangling rope from the top of them. They found at least 15 giant trees, all of which were over 230 feet tall, and some easily topping 262 feet. Surprisingly, in this diverse tropical forest, all these trees were of the same exact species, Angulum vermelho. This species is common in the Amazon, often used for timber because of its strong, albeit smelly wood. Previously, however, it was thought to grow only as high as about 196 feet. Let me drop for a second. They don't yet know how these trees managed to grow so much higher. As pioneer species, the first to grow into any new areas or gaps in vegetation, it's possible that they took advantage of some past disturbance that cleared part of the forest, perhaps caused by a storm or by human habitation. The fact that they've survived so long and grown so tall must be at least in part thanks to their sheer remoteness from urban areas and industry. The laser scanning technology that has enabled this and other recent mammoth tree discoveries isn't just a plaything for tree lovers, though. It allows scientists to map forest structures and carbon storage in amazing detail and at unprecedented scales, and so better assess their importance in the global carbon cycle. A number of projects are also collecting repeat data, which will allow us to monitor the changing health in vital forests like these. In this case, researchers suggest that the northeast of the Amazon could store far more carbon than previously thought. Each Angulum vermelho can store as much as 40 tons of carbon. That's between 300 and 500 smaller trees while occupying the space of only 20. And although they only visited 15 trees, this was a small portion of the trees the laser scanning data revealed, which was itself covered only by a tiny portion of the Guiana Shield. So there are likely to be many more giant trees out there, and some of them may be even taller than these record breakers. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
VDH with a question.
Yes, John.
I take it that that reference to the amount of carbon refers to the carbon dioxide that it's taking out of the air, or does it refer to that what's taking up from the ground?
The way that plants work is you can't really extract the carbon from the ground. The overwhelming majority of the carbon found in plants and trees are basically the result of photosynthesis, of absorbing the carbon dioxide in the air and fixing it to either sugars or complex organic molecules that make up its body.
And also giving off oxygen too, I take it.
So the photosynthesis, basically what it amounts to is photosynthesis with the energy of the photons. They split water molecules, they give off the oxygen into the air, they take the protons and use the chemical bonds of the protons to fuel the chain of synthesis that fixes the carbon dioxide into carbohydrates and from there amino acids and deoxyribonucleic acids and all the wonderful organic compounds that we're made of.
VUS2N.
Yes, Paul.
Yeah, on the same note, so therefore, if you burn that tree, you take that massive thing and you burn it all 100%, does that all, does the carbon that it absorbed all get released into the atmosphere again? Or is it because it went through these chemical changes that you just described, you know, maybe you're not going to wind up with that same amount of carbon put back into the atmosphere. Is that true?
Oh, you know, as I've said many times, you know, energy cannot be created nor destroyed. It can only be transmuted into a different type of energy or moved around. Sort of the same thing for the most part with matter. Carbon is carbon. I guess theoretically you can strike it with neutrons and turn it into a different, you know, transmute it into a different element, but short of nuclear playing around with it, it's a carbon atom. So if you burn the tree completely, then all what you've effectively done is you freed all that carbon back into carbon dioxide and to a small extent carbon monoxide.
Okay, that's not good, you know, because in the news lately, Australia is burning up, well, millions of acres, of, you know, are on fire, so, you know, you can see what's happening there, all that carbon floating away, and, you know, all these countries don't have boundary lines where it stops, it just keeps going around the earth. Not good.
I agree with you, Paul. That's one of the flaws with the concept of growing a million trees and thereby solving our problem. Not only do you have to realize that a lot of those plantlings, treelings, never quite make it to a full healthy tree, and that it can take decades for them to grow enough to have a significant amount of carbon absorption. But you also have to worry about most trees have all trees have a lifetime. When they die and they rot away, basically all the carbon tends to for the most part, if you burn it, certainly, all of it goes into carbon dioxide. If you're talking about the great biodiversity and bacteria that can consume cellulose, you might have a little turnover into other organic compounds. But if we lock down all the carbon in trees, that's all fine and dandy, but then what do you do with the dead trees? You have to then somehow put them in a place where they won't decay back into carbon dioxide. We had that millions of years ago with the coal deposits and oil deposits and natural gas. But short of doing something like that, if you just leave a tree out there in the forest to rot away, most of the carbon is just going to return into the air. So we got problems. We're burning all of the stored up carbons in the fossil fuels that we've been using for the last 100-plus years. And we haven't kind of come up with a clever idea of how to trap carbon and lock it away someplace for future use.
I know a lot of it's supposed to get absorbed into the ocean somehow, so maybe that's the answer. Yeah. But, what happened there? You know, you would have thought that would be the answer. You know, it'd have billions of pounds of carbon get absorbed into our water system.
That's not necessarily a good thing either, because when you take carbon dioxide and you dissolve it into water, you get something called carbonic acid. And life really likes their pH to be a specific pH. If you start to pour acid into the oceans, that's not fun for the organisms living there. Usually the problem is that the majority of photosynthesis is still believed to take place in water. There's the algae and the plant life that's in the ocean. To the most part, the primary limitation is not carbon dioxide, it's sunlight. If it can get through the layers of the water, then you're going to have more photosynthesis. So increasing the amount of dissolved carbon dioxide might increase the photosynthesis a touch, But then you're kind of stuck with the same problem in that these plants don't just kind of suck up the carbon and then they go and bury themselves someplace. They do that, and then they decay, and there's turnover, and bubbles up carbon dioxide into the air, and so you're stuck again. So it's a big problem.
Okay, so there's no answer to that. That means all the fossil fuels that we burnt up, we shouldn't have burnt up, because now there's no way to put the fossil fuels back into the ground. That's what you're saying. So, you're saying there's no hope.
No, I'm not necessarily saying that there's no hope. We can look into different technologies to capture carbon in a way that's not going to just go back into the environment. We can look towards energy devices that can be implemented without the use of fossil fuels, so you have to burn less of the old carbon stores and leave them buried in the ground where they sort of do best. There are all kinds of things. I mean, I would really like people to take their heads out of their backsides and reconsider the nuclear options. I understand that solar energy and wind energy and thermal energy strike people as much cleaner and healthier, but they're somewhat, unfortunately, less inherently reliant day in and day out, and so a nuclear option to one degree or another is probably reasonable as long as you make it as error-proof as human beings can do. I think this has to be a kind of a multi-headed solution. There's not going to be anything simple. We're not going to be able to grow enough corn to turn into fuel because, you know, that isn't how things work. And plus, the amount of energy required to grow the whole corn for methanol and such is probably more than you're getting from the methanol. So there's a whole bunch of feel-good solutions that aren't really terribly useful. And I don't know. Science keeps looking for more of them, and I hope they find enough to help this situation. Okay, on with the next. We've talked about how the present state of the art of home genetic testing is a little bit more accurate than your usual tarot reading or astrological prediction. A new study this very month is the latest to suggest that our genes really don't do much to predict our health, at least most of the time. The study published in PLOS One is a review of the science surrounding genome-wide associated studies. These are studies that look at the genes of thousands, even millions of people at once in order to see whether any of our common variations called single nucleotide polymorphisms are linked to the emergence of medical conditions or traits. Lots of single nucleotide polymorphisms or genetic markers have been singled out as risk factors for hundreds of diseases and aspects of our humanity. But as mentioned before, our genetics tends to only have a tiny influence on why you might develop something like type 2 diabetes or heart disease. Much more important are our environment and lifestyle habits. The authors behind this new study wanted to better quantify the influences of genetics on health, as well as how this influence compares to other markers and predictors of health, like the proteins found in our blood or our metabolism. They devised a new model to analyze publicly available data from over 500 gene analyses covering 200 medical conditions. Some conditions, like Crohn's disease, were heavily impacted by genetics, according to their model, with genes accounting for up to 50% of a person's risk of developing it. But across the board, these markers often had little predictive power, even when combined, the authors found. Simply put, DNA is not your destiny, and single nucleotide polymorphisms are duds for disease prediction, said study author David Wishart, a biologist and researcher at the University of Alberta in Canada, in a statement released by the university. The vast majority of diseases, including many cancers, diabetes, and Alzheimer's disease, have a genetic contribution of 5 to 10% at best. Just let me drop for a second. That's not to say that the connection between your health and genes isn't worth continuing to study. New important genetic causes for various illnesses are being discovered all the time, and in the future, we'll likely better understand how genes interact with lifestyle factors like diet and our environment. But for now, you should remain skeptical of companies trying to sell you a genetic horoscope for your future using these markers. Well, the bottom line is that if you want to have an accurate measure of your health, your propensity for disease, or what you can do about it, it's better to measure your metabolites, your microbes, and your proteins, not your genes, said Wishart. The research also highlights the need to understand our environment and the safety or quality of our food, air, and water. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
AC2 Bravo.
Yes, Rich.
I don't know if you can hear me okay. Info from the genome will tell us everything about us, including making designer drugs for. How did it go from that to this?
Yeah, about three-quarters of your comments got through. You're a little clipping at times. Unfortunately, human beings are prone to things like optimism and pessimism and cynicism. And especially researchers tend to, when they write things up, and especially people who write articles up, always kind of veer into optimism, that we have now discovered the secret of everything. It's the code book to unkey everything. And we're done. We're finished. It's just, we have to just dot the I's and cross the T's. And then you find out that science is like an onion. It has layers and then layers and then layers. I think it never goes to a center. It's always layers. So genetics is very important. And a lack of understanding of genetics is not a good thing. But is it the be-all, end-all? Is it the thing that determines everything? No. Life is complicated, as the old saying goes. And they figured that out even in China, where you can clone a dog or a cat. That doesn't necessarily mean that you're getting your dog or your cat back, which many customers have been kind of upset when the dog or cat doesn't quite act or look like their old dog or cat. Because there are some things that are basically just variable expressions that are random chance, even given the same blueprints. It's like giving an architect, the people building your house the architect's plans, but telling them they could jazz it up and change it depending upon how they feel that day. You hopefully will get a structure that will be reasonably good, but it's not going to look exactly like the floor plans that your architect wrote.
About 15 years ago, every day, you know, how wondrous this area of science was. I don't remember any scientist back then. Wait a minute, this isn't as accurate as you think it is. Why did it take so long?
Because they didn't have the opportunity of the facts. They just had wonderful theories. And the theory was that we are the basic sum total of our genetic precursors. This goes beyond the complicating factor that by methylating groups of our genes in one way or another, you change the expression rate and quality of the expressions of those genes. The more that you look into the things, the more you see the complicating contradictions and the problems. Things look simple at first when you don't really know much of anything and you're just fumbling around in the dark. But you shine a bright light and you see all the nooks and crannies and complications. So I don't think it's malice on their part. I don't think they were conning anyone. I think the Human Genome Project was an incredible scientific venture, and that we're still getting rewards from to this day. soon you will be able to sequence the average human being for a reasonable price at a reasonable efficient time frame, and that can only help things. Will it give you the answer to everything? Unfortunately, nothing gives you the answer to everything. But, you know, that's the way science works. You tend to be optimistic. It kind of helps drive both the exercise and the financing for it.
You pay them your thoughts and for what you're going to die from?
Okay, about two-thirds of that was broken up. You cannot predict what a person's going to die of based on their genetic profile. In differing degrees, there are some disorders that are caused more by genetic factors, and others that less the genetic factors. There are hereditary types of disorders that put you at a much higher risk for developing these diseases, but it doesn't definitively predict what you'll get, when you'll get it, and what you'll die of.
Thanks a lot, W2BZ.
Welcome, Rich. Anyone else with any questions or comments about this one before I move on to the next one? Okay, we're going to touch back on something that we talked about a little bit earlier. More than a few people have suggested that the general population appears to be more cognitively impaired these days than they remember in their younger days. Now, scientists may have discovered what might be making this problem worse. Climate change is ruining our air quality and contributing to a public health catastrophe, but there's more, apparently. Researchers are warning in a new paper that the very greenhouse gas that's driving most of our global warming, you know, carbon dioxide, is also apparently diminishing indoor air quality and maybe messing with our ability to make decisions and think strategically. The research was presented at this year's annual American Geophysical Union fall meeting and submitted to the journal GeoHealth for peer review. The findings focus on students of the future. Today's students already face obstacles due to the increased risk of classroom heat in a warmer world. It turns out rising carbon dioxide could only make things worse. Previous research has looked at the impact of indoor air pollution and carbon dioxide levels on test scores. Carbon dioxide levels tend to build up in confined spaces, especially ones with poor ventilation, because we all exhale it. Improving ventilation solves that, bringing in more air from the outside. Research shows that reducing levels could improve math scores, but in a world ravaged by extreme carbon emissions, improving ventilation might actually make the situation worse. That led the researchers on this new study to develop a model to see what the future might hold. That model includes the typical number of students in a classroom, the size of the classroom, and the usual ventilation rates and the impact each has on cognitive functioning. The paper then ran that model under at least two commonly used climate scenarios, including one where the world cuts carbon emissions starting in mid-century, and another where they continue to rise dramatically. The findings show that the basic decision-making ability in people in a classroom setting could decrease by about 25% by 2100 due to increased carbon dioxide in the worst-case scenario. Students' complex strategic thinking abilities may drop by some 50% by the end of the century if carbon emissions continue to increase under the business-as-usual carbon emission scenario. The youth are the future, and one with a bunch of kids struggling to get an education doesn't sound like a great one. Shelley Miller, a co-author and professor of environmental engineering at the University of Colorado at Boulder, said that it also raises questions about how ventilation should be designed in the future to ensure that it's not it's doing more harm than good. While a future of continually rising emissions sounds terrible, the study also found, however, that these results are almost entirely avoidable by reducing global carbon dioxide emissions.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Okay, somehow I timed out the repeater. I'll go to the last part of this. What researchers do know is this. Humans have never experienced the atmospheric levels of carbon dioxide this high, let alone if the worst-case scenarios come to fruition. We already know so much about the risks of carbon pollution poses to the climate, but we still have so much to learn about how it could affect other things, and that's in part why Miller looked more closely at